Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the lawyers when we come back. You know, a fellow once made an observation. His name is Paul Harvey. You ever heard Paul Harvey and the rest of the story? Well, Paul Harvey made an observation one time. He said, if there's a stain on the record of our forefathers, a dark hour in the earliest history of the American colonies, it would be the hanging of the so-called witches at Salem. But that was a pinpoint in place and time. It was a brief lapse into hysteria. For the most part, our 17th century colonists were scrupulously fair, even in fear. There was one group of people that they feared, and feared with reason, a society, you might say, whose often insidious craft had claimed a multitude of victims ever since the Middle Ages in Europe. One group of people were hated. One group of people was feared. From Massachusetts Bay to Virginia, the magistrates would not burn them at the stake, although a great many colonists might have recommended such a solution. Our forefathers were baffled by them, and in the first place, where did they come from? Of all the people who sailed from England to Plymouth in 1620, not one of these two-legged vermin was on board the Mayflower. Vermin. That's what the colonists called them. Parasites who fed on human misery. They were spreading sorrow and confusion wherever they went. Destructive, they were called. And still, they were permitted coexistence with the colonists. Well, for a while anyway. Of course, there were colonial laws prohibiting the practice of their infamous craft. Somehow, a way was always found around those laws, though. In 1641, Massachusetts Bay Colony took a novel approach to the problem. The governors attempted to starve those devils out of existence through economic exclusion. They were denied wages, and thereby it was hoped that they would perish. 4 years later, Virginia followed the example of Massachusetts Bay, and for a while, it seemed that the dilemma had been resolved. It had not. However, these parasites managed to survive, and the mere nearness of them made the colonists' skin crawl. In 1658 in Virginia, the final solution, banishment, exile, the treacherous ones were cast out of the colony. At last, after decades of enduring the psychological gloom, the sun came out and the birds sang and all was right with the world. And the elation continued for more than a generation. Now, I'm not sure why the Virginians eventually allowed these outcasts to return, but they did. In 1680, after 22 years, these despised ones were readmitted to the colony on the condition that they be subjected to the strictest surveillance. But how soon we forget. For indeed, over the next half century or so, the imposed restrictions were slowly and quietly swept away. And those whose treachery had been feared since the Middle Ages ultimately took their place in society. You see, the vermin that once infested colonial America, the parasites who preyed upon the misfortune of their neighbors until finally they were officially banished from Virginia, those dreaded, despised, outcast masters of confusion were lawyers. Lawyers. That's from Paul Harvey, the rest of the story. But the story of lawyers doesn't end there. That's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, Jesus of Nazareth had something to say about lawyers. He didn't have a lot good to say about lawyers, preachers, or bankers, but he did have something to say. And he started off one time in Luke 11, verse 37, with the Pharisees. He started off with the preachers. Here's what Jesus had to say about preachers. And then in verse 45, he started on the lawyers. Listen to this. And as he spoke, a certain Pharisee besought him to dine with him, and he went in and he sat down to meat. He sat down for dinner. And when the Pharisee saw it, he marveled that he had not first washed before dinner. Now this Pharisee was a very astute observer, and he observed Jesus come in, sat down to eat, and he didn't wash his hands. Can you believe it? Jesus sat down to eat and didn't wash his hands. Why, my granny would have been all over him like flies on stink for coming to the dinner table without washing his hands, and this Pharisee, no dummy. He saw that right away. And when the Pharisee saw it, he marveled that he had not first washed before dinner. And the Lord said unto him, Now do you Pharisees make clean the outside of the cup and the platter, and your inward part is full of ravening and wickedness? You fools, did not he that made that which is without make that which is within also? But rather give alms to such things as you have, and behold, all things are clean unto you. But woe unto you, Pharisees! For you tithe mint and rue, and all manner of herbs, and pass over judgment and the love of God. These ought you to have done, and not to have left the other undone. He said, Woe unto you, Pharisees! For you love the uppermost seats in the synagogues and the greetings in the markets. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites! For you are as graves which appear not, and the men walk over them, and are not aware of them. Where you see the word Pharisees and scribes, you could put in there pastors, preachers, the sky pilots, and the holy Joes. From Genesis to Revelation, there is not one good word in the Bible about a preacher. And if there is, send me a letter and let me know who it is, would you? Then he went on a little further, and he talked about the lawyers. Remember, he's the guy that threw the money changers, the bankers, out of the temple. They were conducting business in the temple. He threw them out. That didn't set well with the banking committee, community. And this little statement here, I imagine, doesn't set very well with the religious community either, because they haven't forgot it. There isn't a preacher in the country that has a good word about the law of God or about Jesus of Nazareth either. Oh, they come to you, and they have pious words, but remember that the Messiah called them hypocrites. And in Luke 6, verse 46, he had an observation about you preachers out there that you ought to take to heart. He said, Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? They come into church every Sunday, you know, and they talk about Jesus and him crucified and love Jesus and love, love, love. But the scripture tells you what love is. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. You ever heard a preacher have a good word about the Ten Commandments? About the law of God? I've yet to hear a preacher with a good word about the law of God. They always tell you it's abolished and done away with, and it's nailed to the cross with Jesus, and you don't need to worry about thou shalt not commit adultery. Jesus understands your weakness. Go on down to Flo's whorehouse and tear off a piece on Friday night. It's okay. He understands. Now the lawyers came in for a little upbraiding also. In verse 45 he said, Then answered one of the lawyers. So evidently this preacher must have had a lawyer there at the dinner table with him. You'll find these lawyers in church too, like Bill Clinton carrying the Bible out of church. Which is about like watching, you know, Jimmy Swaggart come out of a whorehouse. So one of the lawyers who were sitting there at the table with him, he said, Woe unto you also, you lawyer. For you laid men with burdens grievous to be borne. And you yourselves touch not those burdens with one of your fingers. He said, Woe unto you, for you build the sepulchres of the prophets, and your fathers killed them. He called them murderers. The lawyers called them murderers. Woe unto you, for you build the sepulchres of the prophets, and your fathers killed them. Yeah, they've got big monuments out here, you know, like monuments to John Kennedy. Remember that? With the eternal flame under there, but he was murdered. He said, Therefore also said the wisdom of God, I will send them prophets and apostles, and some of them they shall slay and persecute. And the blood of all of the prophets which was shed from the foundation of the world may be required of this generation, from the blood of Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, which perished between the altar and the temple. Truly I say unto you, it shall be required of this generation. Woe unto you lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. Ye entered not in yourselves, and them that were entering in ye hindered. And as he said these things unto him, the scribes and the Pharisees began to urge him vehemently, and to provoke him, and to speak many things, laying wait for him, and seeking to catch something out of his mouth that they might accuse him with. That's the lawyers and the preachers. Laying in wait, seeking to get something out of the Messiah's mouth so that they could kill him. Now that's what he had to say about preachers and lawyers. Why is it then that lawyers are being elected in record numbers to the Congress of the United States and to our legislatures? Why is it that when you get into trouble, the first thing you want is a lawyer? There's an old adage, you know, when you get into trouble, all of your friends will say, Bob, what you need is a good lawyer. I've never heard anybody advise me, George, what you need is a mediocre lawyer. This isn't a real bad problem. You don't need a good lawyer, just a mediocre lawyer is all you need. I've never had anybody advise me to get a poor lawyer. Ah, George, this is no big deal. Just go out and get any run-of-the-mill poor lawyer, any dumb lawyer, any ignorant lawyer, any incompetent lawyer. Any lawyer can handle this. It's no big deal. Now, they always told me, oh, my God, George, you need a good lawyer. Can you tell me, boys and girls, what does a good lawyer look like? How do you recognize the good lawyers from the mediocre lawyers or the bad lawyers? Our Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, a guy by the name of Warren Burger, back in 1978, was addressing, in Las Vegas, Nevada, he was addressing the National Bar Association. And in his speech, he said 90% of the lawyers in this country are incompetent. He was speaking of the trial lawyers. He said 90% of these suckers are incompetent. This is the chief judge of the United States. This is a guy that ought to know. I just, from my vantage point in life, after having observed lawyers as an old man, having observed lawyers for 40 or 50 years, I would concur with the Chief Justice's remarks. About 90% of them are incompetent. That's just about right. Yeah, I'd agree with that. That's been my experience. I've hired a couple of lawyers in my day. I used to have a lawyer in our company. I wouldn't say it was on our staff. We had one on retainer. You know, a guy that you pay $6,000 a year to, back when $6,000 amounted to a couple of shekels between your fingers. $6,000 a year, I had this guy on retainer. What that means is that when you come in, you know, to your telephone, I had a list of buttons down the side. I think there's 24 buttons on my phone, if I remember right. And you didn't have to dial the number. You just push this button for Bickle. You just push this button for Johnson. You push this button over here for Thriftway. And it would dial it automatically for you. That's what you get for $6,000. $6,000 a year. And I had this guy hired for me, and we did three cases. Now, he wrote lots of contracts. I mean, you know, as a businessman, my God, God only knows what might happen to a businessman who didn't have a lawyer reviewing all of his contracts. So we used to write a lot of contracts. We used to make a lot of business deals. You know, businesses do that. And so we'd run all these contracts by our lawyer, and he'd rubber stamp them, or he'd say, yeah, that's pretty good. In fact, he'd write up the contracts. He got all the business. He wrote up the contracts. And then we'd go out and execute them. You know, and God, that really made us feel good, because now we had the stamp of approval of a legal beagle. You know, a guy that's been to law school, a paid professional, a guy that knows something. That's what we wanted, was a guy that knew something. Some guy that we could rely upon. After all, we were all legal incompetents in our company. We wasn't anybody in there that knew anything about the law. We'd been all educated in public school. So old Bickle, nice guy that he was, you could go into his office. I always marveled at all the pieces of paper he had on the wall. He had a waiting room, you know. You couldn't go right into the inner sanctum, you know. You come in and sit there in the office with his secretary out in front, his receptionist over there. And as you're sitting there, you know, reading Time Magazine or Life or Look or something like that, you look up on the wall, and here was a piece of paper from the University of Illinois. Here was a piece of paper from this or that graduate school. And here was a piece of paper from this or that bar association or this or that legal organization that said, this lawyer is real smart, this lawyer is real good, this lawyer is real knowledgeable, this lawyer is the guy you want to rely upon. I don't know how many pieces of paper were up there on the wall, but there was 20 or 30 of them. You're sitting there, just kind of mulling things over, waiting your turn, and you're counting the holes in the ceiling tiles, and you're looking at the piece of papers on the wall. It's made me feel real good that I had a lawyer that put lots of pieces of paper on his wall telling me how smart he was. Well, one time I did a job for this lady over here, and she didn't pay me. And I got a little ticked off about that, and so I went to my lawyer, Bickle, and I said, no, this lady didn't pay me, and I want to sue her to collect the money, or I want to lean on her house or something like that. And so Bickle said, well, fine, and so he charged me his fee, and we went to work on the case. And so as time wore on, the case finally came to trial, and I told Bickle what had happened, gave him all the facts, and I told him about what they were lying about. You know, discovery was out of the way, and I said, that's a lie, and this is the truth, and that's a lie, and they didn't do that, and here's what I did, and here's what they did. And he had all the information. Tried the case in front of Judge Willis, Magistrate Court, 4th Judicial District, Boise, Idaho, Judge Willis. And so here's Willis. He's sitting up there on the bench, and here's my lawyer putting on the case, and so he's calling witnesses. And so when the husband of this woman got on the stand, you know, I said, now remember, this guy's lying about this, this, and this. Make sure that you question him closely concerning this. Bickle patted my ignorant little hand, and he said, I'll take care of it. And he went about his business. When he got all done, he hadn't covered those crucial elements, those important facts. I was just outraged. I was just sitting there on the edge of my seat, ready to jump up and down, paw the ground, and bite the bushes. And so a little break came along, and I said, well, how come you didn't ask him about this and this and this? And what about that and that and that? And what was all this all about? He patted me on my little pointed hand again, you know, and he said, you just sit back. I got everything under control. Got everything under control. Oh, okay. Okay. That's my guardian over there. He's telling me everything's under control. Called this guy's wife and put her on the stand. And I said, now you got to watch this and this and this. And I said, now make sure you talk about this and that and another thing, and make sure that you cover this and that and another thing, you know. And he patted me on my hand. He said, I got everything under control. So he examined her. And I was sitting on the edge of my seat, jumping up and down, pawing the ground, biting the bushes, and doing all those things that nervous, incompetent people do. And I was sitting there, and he didn't ask her half the questions that I thought he ought to be asking. And he didn't do a very good job, in my view. And I'm paying this guy a lot of money, and there's a lot of money at stake, you know, at least to my thinking, it's a lot of money to me. And I didn't think he did a very good job with her. And he got through, and then a little break came, and I asked him, well, how come you didn't ask her this, that, and another thing, blah, 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 blah. And he said, well, you know, I've got everything under control. Just sit back and relax. So some more time goes on. Another witness got on the stand, another one of them Lion cheats, and so Bickle's asking some questions. And when he got to the end of it, he said, I have no further questions. I couldn't contain myself. I was so excited. I was so ticked off. I jumped up and I said, well, I've got some questions for him. Remember, I'm the plaintiff. Well, I've got some questions for him. And the judge, he was so shocked when I said, I've got some questions. There was total silence. And Willis, the judge, he practically came across the bench. I thought he was going to fly down there and eat my lunch. And he said, Mr. Gordon, you're out of order. You got that? I'm the plaintiff in this case. I'm paying for this. And the judge says, you're out of order. One more outburst like that from you, and I'll hold you in contempt. Good, I hadn't been talked to like that since my daddy told me to get my elbows off the table. I mean, that's the judge. He told me he's going to hold me in contempt for having the temerity to say that I was going to ask this guy, this lying, perjured sucker, some questions that my lawyer hadn't asked him. Taught me a lesson. Boy, you sit down, shut up, fold your hands, and enjoy the ride. Well, the ultimate end of the case was that we lost. We lost the case. No surprise to me. I think that if I was sitting on the jury, I'd have voted against us too. I don't think we proved our case. I don't think we asked the right questions. I don't think we got in the right information. I wouldn't say that my lawyer threw the case on purpose, but I wouldn't doubt it. I don't know what the hell my lawyer was talking to the other lawyer about. I don't know what kind of deals they were making behind closed doors, but I can tell you that there's a lot of deals that get made. A lot of deals that get made. Now, this guy, Bickle, wrote up a lot of contracts, and three of these contracts ended up in litigation. Three ended up in litigation. Now, here's the way this lawyer thing works. So you pay this guy $6,000 a year, year in and year out. That's so you can get access to him. And then after you get into his office, he charges you for the work he does. But for $6,000, you can get to the head of the line. You don't have to sit there and wait and wait and wait. I mean, you know, when I called him, you know, I could get right in. That's what you're paying for. All right. So now when you get right in and you say, okay, now we got this problem. This guy didn't pay his bill over here and we need to sue him, or we need to do this or that. Or maybe it's the other guy suing us for breach of contract and then we need to defend. Well, it didn't make any difference. You know, you go to a lawyer and you have him write these contracts. The objective is to keep you out of trouble. That's the objective. We don't want to go to court. We don't want to have to go litigate some contract. We want to make contracts. We want to deliver the goods. We want to collect the money. That's what business is all about. We're not interested in fighting with people. You know, most customers aren't interested in fighting with their suppliers. Now, once in a while, disagreements come up. So once in a while, there's litigation that's necessary. That's the purpose for courts, and that's the purpose for litigation and the judicial process. When you get to a point where you can't solve the problem, then you have to have somebody that can solve the problem for you, and that's what the judge is there for. But, you know, we hire lawyers to keep us out of trouble, and that was the purpose for hiring Bickle, keep me out of trouble. Well, three times he failed. Now, that should have been a clue to me. You know, by the time you get into court three times, this guy has failed three times in his mission, which was to keep you out of trouble to start with, to keep you out of court. So he failed three times. And out of those three times, we lost three cases. I mean, we went in and argued those cases. We lost three times. I told you about that when we lost it. There was two more that we did, and we lost. Three times, three ups and three downs. Now I'm paying this guy $6,000 a year. Then you got to pay him $5,000 to take the case on. Then you got all of these depositions and costs, you know, that come up. And then you got to pay for all of that. And then you go in and you argue your case, and then you lose. See how that works? You pay $6,000 a year so you can get into the lawyer's office, so that you can give him the case, pay him another $5,000 to $10,000 to go in and argue the case for you in court, and then lose. This went on, you know, for a number of years, 6 years. So I paid $36,000, $6,000 a year for 6 years. That's $36,000, and then we did three cases. That cost $5,000 each. So that's $50,000 plus the costs that go into it, probably another $10,000. So we're in this $50,000-$60,000, right? All right. So we're in this thing $50,000 or $60,000, and we lose the three cases that we went in to fight. Now, first of all, it cost me $60,000 because he didn't keep me out of trouble. And then second, when we went in there to defend ourselves or went in there to get our money, we lost. Boys and girls, you don't need to pay a lawyer $50,000 to lose. You know, it doesn't take any brains to go into court and lose. You don't need to pay some lawyer $50,000 to go in there and represent you and then lose. Hell, you could go in there by yourself and lose free. I always tell my students that, hell, you don't have to pay to go into court and lose. You can do it for nothing. So one day I woke up and I said, you know, this lawyer thing over here in real practice doesn't work very well. This guy's a nice guy. He's real smart. Got lots of pieces of paper on the wall. But he's incompetent. Is he dumb? No. No, this guy's really smart. Now, a lawyer, first off, is an entrepreneur. A lawyer is an entrepreneur. He's in business for himself. He's not in business for George Gordon. He's not in business for you. He's in business for himself. He's there to make as much money off of his clients as he can. He's a businessman, just like you are. He's a businessman who's trying to make as much money as he can off of each and every deal that comes in his door. If he has a happy, satisfied customer that comes back year after year, like I did for 6 years, if he has a happy, satisfied customer that goes in and loses and comes back and buys more and goes in and loses and comes back and buys more, I mean, it's like you go in and you buy a car. And you're out driving your car, and the thing is a lemon, and it's broke down half the time, and it's in the shop all the time, and they're trying to fix it all the time. They never get the thing fixed, and you're always having problems with it. But if you come back and buy another one of those, that's good for the dealer. And your second car is a lemon, and it doesn't work worth a darn, and so you're just having problems with it. And so you come back a third time. I mean, you know, if you're not smart enough to wake up after the first, second, or third time, you know, that's not the fault of the dealer. The dealer has to sell what he's got. If he's selling Fords and it's a lemon, well, okay, but, you know, I'm a Ford dealer, and that's what I'm here to sell is Fords. Lawyers are there to sell their services. Now, you'd think that a lawyer would give you good advice. And there was an outfit called Bob Jones University. I got to tell you the story about Bob Jones when we come back. But let me give you a reminder here before we get any further into the program. And that is that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Remember, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call us at the Law School. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Tonight's report on the lawyers. Well, everybody needs a lawyer. And at some point in your life, you're going to need a lawyer because 2% of us get arrested every year. Did you know that? That's right. 2% of the people of America get arrested every year. Let's just try that. 300 times 0.02 is 6 million people a year. 6 million people a year. Those 6 million people all need lawyers. And they go out and they hire a lawyer. And remember, your friends, that is your mom and dad, your brothers and sisters, your friend Bob is going to tell you, George, what you need is a good lawyer. So you're going to go out and hire a lawyer. Now, here's your statistical odds. If you've got a criminal case, you've been arrested, you got a criminal case, you've been charged with income tax evasion, or you've been charged with fraud or some white-collar crime, you're a Ken Lay, and you're going on trial for bankrupting Enron or whatever it is, your chances of winning that case statistically are 6%. That's right. You go out and hire a lawyer, and you go into court with that lawyer, and you follow all of your lawyer's advice. You do exactly what your lawyer tells you. And this is the mix of good lawyers and bad lawyers, all of them together, 90% of whom are incompetent, so says our Chief Justice, and your chances of winning your case are 6%. Hell, with a 6% chance of winning, you can do better on the field. The worst bet on a crap table is the field. You got a better bet on the field than a crap table. You got better odds on a slot machine than you have at winning a case in court. You know, I hate to be the guy that rains on your parade, but the minute you hire that lawyer and you walk into court with that lawyer, your chances of losing are 94%. Your chances of winning are 6%. Now, that's the national average. I don't make these numbers. I'm just telling you. It's the way that game is played. Well, I didn't know that, you know, when I was hiring my man Friday. Well, Bickle, I didn't know what the odds were, but, you know, later on I figured it out. I read it in the National Law Journal. You know, the lawyers' papers. I subscribe to Lawyers Weekly and the National Law Journal and Lawyers Alert, and these are the newsletters that go to lawyers, and they tell us what the odds are, what the statistics are, what the facts are. They're like insurance companies; they keep track of those kinds of numbers. So the next time you have a criminal charge against you, remember this: if you're as dumb as a box of rocks, you've never been in court in your entire life. If you elect not to hire an attorney, and you elect to represent yourself. And you walk into court, and you take the witness stand in your own defense, and you just tell the judge or you just tell the jury your side of the story. You don't have to object. You don't have to know anything. You don't have to be trained or skilled. You're just a dumb housewife, a blonde. Hell, you could do this if you got blonde hair. But get on the witness stand. Just get up there and tell your side of the story. And your chances of winning go up 10 full percentage points to 16%. And your chances of losing drop to 84. Now, that's totally unacceptable. I would be the first to admit that if your chances of winning are only 16% and you're going to lose 84% of the time, you haven't even got a 50-50 bet here. I mean, it isn't even like a field bet, 65-35. But, I mean, it's a hell of a lot better. It's 10 percentage points better than hiring a lawyer, and you don't have to hire the lawyer, and you save $10,000 or $15,000. I mean, just think of the upside of it. You can lose, but it won't cost you anything. As opposed to you can lose, and it's going to cost you $50,000. Reminds me of an old buddy of mine. His name was Tupper Saucy. Tupper was a hell of a nice guy. He published a paper called The Main Street Journal, wrote a couple of three books. He's a tax protester. I've got a lot more in common with tax protesters than I do with tax collectors. And we have more tax protesters come to school here than tax collectors. But anyway, old Tupper was a pretty good old boy. I always liked him. And we were talking about taxes and one thing and another. And I told him what I thought concerning taxes, and he disagreed with me. He didn't think that I knew what I was talking about. And he was probably right. I'm not very bright. I'm a high school dropout. I didn't go all the way through high school. And I didn't go to college. And I'm not very, very skilled. I didn't get very, very good grades when I was there. You know, I wasn't a straight A student. But this old boy, Tupper, he was probably a straight A student, went to college, and he very, very smart, very intelligent fellow. And he had his ideas, and he asked me what I thought, and I said, well, here's what I think. And he disagreed, and he said, well, no, I don't think that's correct. Well, I went my way, and he went his way. And one day, my wife told me that Tupper was being prosecuted for tax evasion or willful failure to file, I believe it was, willful failure to file, and file his tax return. Now, my theory has always been that if you don't have any income, you probably won't be prosecuted for tax evasion. That was just an old country boy's take on it. You know, I saw these people being prosecuted for tax evasion, and I thought, what causes tax evasion? What causes willful failure to file? See, well, most people have income. Most people want income. Most people work real hard to get more income. In fact, when I went to school, they taught me that I wanted income. They taught me to work hard and make lots of income. I did. And then I had to pay a lot of income tax. The more income you make, the more income tax you got to pay. Kind of like a lawyer, you know. You go out here and you get into trouble, you got to have a good lawyer. That's because that's what all the pundits say. That's what all of the people around you say. They say, you got to go to college. You know, they tell every kid, you got to go to college. If you want to make something of yourself, you've got to go to college. And so they got all these kids going to college now. Then they come out of college and they can't get a job. Well, they can get a job in China or England or Indonesia or Bangladesh. They can't get a job here in the United States. That's because there's no employment here. The employment's all over in China or India. You can go to work in India, you know. You can't get jobs here. You go to college. I got to thinking about that one time, and I thought, well, every kid that goes into the public school system from the first grade to the 12th grade is carefully groomed and advised and taught and trained that he must go to college. Aren't they? Weren't you? I was. Okay, let's carry that out to its ultimate conclusion. Every kid going into the first grade in the year 2006 over the next 12 years is going to prepare and be trained for college. So let's see, in the year 2000, let's add 12 to 6, and we get 12 and 6 is about 2018. About the year 2018, every kid in America now goes to college. 4 years later, every kid between the year 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, okay? So starting about the year 2018, followed for the next 20 years after that, every kid that goes to first grade is taught, trained to go to college. Let's see. In about 20 or 30 years after 2018, by the year 2018, 28, 38, 48, about the middle of the 21st century, we should have everybody in America college trained and graduated from college, okay? Now let me ask you this. As a college graduate, everybody in America now is trained in college. Everybody in America has a college degree. Everybody in America now is a professor, or he's a college graduate. He's a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, a professional. Okay, now, who's going to build the houses and who's going to fix the cars and who's going to haul the garbage? You know, boys and girls, this college thing, if you think about it, doesn't make all that much sense. Now, I don't deny that you need some guys to go to college to become lawyers and some guys to go to college to become doctors and some guys to go to college to become bankers. You got to have some doctors, got to have some lawyers, and got to have some bankers. Now, don't we? How would society function if you didn't have doctors, lawyers, and bankers? Well, just take a look at history and look where we were. Listen, 100 years ago, back in 1906, 100 years ago, the death rate from cancer was 1 in 33. It was better than that. Only one person in 33 would even get cancer. Of course, we didn't have any cancer cures, and so you were going to die from cancer. So it was 1 in 33. After 100 years, with graduating all these millions and millions of medical doctors, the cancer rate now is 1 out of 2. 50%. Every other person is going to get cancer in his lifetime. Thank God we've got colleges and medical schools to graduate more doctors. And then, of course, you got bankers. You know, 1906, you know, we had a few bankers. We had gold and silver coin. We had a national debt that was under $1 billion. And America was the preeminent nation on planet Earth. We were number one in industrial production. We were number one in military and in money and in production. America was number one. Today, we're not number one in any of the 15 leading economic indicators of industrial production. We're the world's number one debtor nation, and we owe $149 trillion, public and private, all of us Americans. We went from $1 billion national debt to $9 trillion in 100 years. I tell you, we need more bankers. And then we got some lawyers in on it. You know, in 1900, I don't know how many lawyers we had per capita, but it wasn't as many as we got now. America has the highest number of lawyers per capita of population than any country in the world. We also have the most litigation. And we also have some of the dumbest warning labels on our products. You know, you go into the store and you buy an iron, and it says, this iron is hot. Be careful that you don't burn yourself. That's called product liability. We got lawyers that sue you for whatever is possible. I mean, if there's anything we can sue you for, we will. You know, this lady walks into McDonald's and gets a cup of hot coffee. It's the only thing that McDonald's ever had that George Gordon could buy was a cup of hot coffee. Now it's tepid. Now it's cold. Now it's, well, it's not cold, but it's not hot. I like hot coffee. This lady drives out, spills the coffee, burns herself, and sues McDonald's, and McDonald's now serves cold coffee. And then they're out here, they want to sue McDonald's because McDonald's is making them fat. See, we don't have individual responsibility in this country anymore. I mean, people can't take a cup of hot coffee and say to themselves, my God, this coffee's hot. If I spill it, I'll probably burn myself. So we expect McDonald's to put a warning label on the coffee cup that says, warning, hot coffee. Be careful, could burn you. McDonald's didn't have that. They got burned for $3 million. Well, that's lawyers. Jesus never had a good word for a lawyer, a banker, or a preacher. Lawyers, bankers, and preachers, all professionals, call the lawyers hypocrites. Call them hypocrites. Now, there's a guy by the name of Jerry Spence. You ever heard that name? Jerry Spence. And then he wrote a couple of three neat books. And then he says, here, I'm looking at the front page here, With Justice for None, Destroying an American Myth by Jerry Spence. He's a lawyer. I don't know if he's a hypocrite or not. Never met him. Never talked to him. Read 5 or 6 of his books, though. He's a pretty good writer. I like his books. He's pretty funny. Pretty funny. I guess that's like reading Mad Magazine, you know. When you're reading the truth, it's funny. You ever notice that? Mad Magazine is always so good. My wife always scolds me, and she says, are you reading that stupid Mad Magazine again? She calls Mad Magazine stupid. Jerry Spence, he wrote a book here called With Justice for None, in which he had a little section over here on lawyers. Little section on lawyers. Here's a lawyer writing about lawyers. Thought I'd share it with you. He said, here's one of his citations. He says, the doctor gathered up 6 books, all the latest on the anatomy of the brain and on the surgical technique demanded. He began his procedure by reading aloud to the others in the operating room, and as he read, they handed him the necessary instruments and helped him identify the special places that he must cut, and he was very conscientious. Nobody accused this doctor of not trying his best. The operation took several hours, including the code blue at the end, when other doctors came running into the operating room, and they administered their last desperate life-saving procedures that all, of course, failed. Well, they say the doctor performed 8 of these operations before one of his patients survived. Some critics who did not understand the problem of medical training claimed that the doctor stacked up the dead and the maimed like cordwood, but perhaps that is the small price that we pay for good medicine. After all, they're called medical practitioners. The doctor has to practice to become good. Well, the doctor was quick to learn from his mistakes, and he had a certain cavalier courage that served him well. He was able to take his early defeats in stride and to dismiss them as part of his education. One of his students asked Jerry Spence this question. He said, how did you get to be so good? He asked. And I replied, I just kept trying cases. I just kept piling up the dead bodies until I finally learned how. I owe the people a lot, I said. And I thought of all of the cases that I had needlessly lost, and I felt sad again. And I felt sad for all of the young lawyers who wanted to win and didn't know how. I felt sad for the people. I thought of the few great lawyers that I knew. Most of them were tucked away anonymously in small towns, in wayward places where people had come to take them for granted. And I thought of the law schools, and my sadness turned to anger again. A pity that we cannot train lawyers for the people. Then I said goodbye to the student, and I walked into the terminal. When I looked back, he was still staring in my direction. Jerry Spence. A guy that makes $10 million a year regularly. I think he's retired now, but when he was practicing, it was $10 million a year. Year in and year out. He was always in the top 10 or 20 lawyers in the country. He had learned from experience how to go into court and win. I did that. I did that. I learned how to go in and win. I looked at the numbers, and I looked at my experience after I had hired a lawyer. And after I'd paid him $60,000 and lost three times, I came to the conclusion, I don't need to pay some guy $60,000 to lose. Hell, I could go in there and lose free. That's what launched me on my pro se career. Yeah, I woke up one day and I said, the next time that I have a legal problem, I'm going to go into court and I'm going to argue it all by myself. I'm not going to get a good lawyer. I'm not even going to get a mediocre lawyer. I'm not even going to get one of those 90% of incompetent lawyers. I'm just going to walk in the door, get up on the witness stand, and tell my story. And when I did, I won. Now, I've hired a lawyer or two in my day and won a case or two also. I've got to be fair. Remember what Jerry said here? He said, good lawyers are tucked away in inauspicious places, like Ben Rice in Cuna, Idaho. I got to tell you a little story here. Old Ben was a country lawyer, Mormon country lawyer, tucked away in a little town called Cuna, K-U-N-A, Idaho. Can you believe a place named Cuna, Idaho? I don't know how many people live there. They got a Pizza Hut there, though. I don't know if there's 1,000 or 2,000 people living in Cuna, Idaho, but old Ben was there. And I had a little problem. See, I was operating a manufacturing company, and the OSHA people came in, and they said that they wanted me to put in a new spray booth. So I argued and fought with them for a long time. And one day, all of my advisors, all of my business associates said, come on, Gordon, shut up and just pay the money and put it in. So we spent $6,000 and put in a new spray booth to OSHA standard. This went on for about 6 months, and one day the EPA guy came in. And the EPA man came in, and he looked at it, and he said, well, this is totally inadequate. You got to rebuild this. You got to build it to our standards. Right away, I figured there's something going wrong here, that the right hand don't know what the left hand doth do, and then you shouldn't have one government agency saying build it to our standards, and then another government agency come in there and say, no, that's all wrong. Do it to our standards. I thought that was kind of stupid and dumb and wrong, but then I wasn't a good socialist. I didn't understand communism. I didn't understand the American way. And so I resisted, and I said, kiss my grits. And that made the government bureaucrat real angry with me. And we got into it, and we got to fight. And one day they charged me with 33 counts of air pollution violations, and they proposed to put me in jail for 33 and a half years and fine me, oh, my God, $17,500. Well, that's the potential. You know, they always tell you 6 months in jail on each count, and 33 counts, or I guess it was a year in jail for each count, or if it was 6 months, it was 17 years or something like that. And then they get real nasty, and they act like a bunch of damn dogs, you know, barking and yapping, and then they make a lot of noise, you know. And so we went to our lawyer, Bickle, and he worked out a plea bargain, you know, pay him $300 and plead guilty, and just made me mad as hell. I said, you know, right's right and wrong's wrong, and I didn't like that program at all, but you know, what are you going to do when you got your lawyer and all your business associates on your back? And so we got to chit-chatting a little bit with old Tracy Wright. And old Tracy, you know, ran the Meridian Exchange. And old Tracy said, well, why don't you go talk to Ben? So I went out and talked to Ben. He was on the exchange, old country lawyer, tucked away in this out-of-the-way place. And he said, yeah. I said, well, that's pretty standard practice. See, they come out here and they charge you with all these charges, see, and they just scare the living hell out of you. And you're facing 17 years or 33 years in prison, a $17,000 fine, and then they got bargain day at Macy's, and they'll settle for $300 if you'll plead guilty. And I said, can you win that? He says, oh, yeah, I can win that. And I said, well, how much is it going to cost to win that? And he said, $4,000, $4,000. I said, you got to be out of your cotton-picking mind. Why, for $300, I can plead guilty, and you want $4,000 to win. He said, yeah, that's the way the game is played. Yeah, that's right. You see, it's so much cheaper for you to go in and plead guilty to something you didn't do than it is to pay me $4,000 to go in and win. But you know, it costs me just as much to go in and win this little Mickey Mouse case for $300 as it does to go in and win some big case for $30,000. Takes just as much of my time to go in and work on this little Mickey Mouse case, whether it's a speeding ticket or whether it's murder one. Taught me a lesson right there. You know, the judicial process works the same whether you're fighting a parking ticket or an O.J. Simpson fighting Murder One. The rules are all the same. I mean, once you know the rules, boys and girls, you know the rules. If you can fight a parking ticket, there's no reason why you can't fight Murder One. Well, of course, some lawyer gonna come along now and say, well, that guy Gordon, he's some kind of nut. Well, I don't know. Over the years now, I've done about 65 cases, 157, or 58 now, I guess 58 now. Lost seven. I'm never going to recover on the seven that I lost, and if I had it to do over again, there's three or four of those seven I probably wouldn't take on. I got a little rambunctious there. But you know, as a pro se litigant, I haven't done too shabby, and I didn't go to college either, and I don't have a law school degree. But then I never did get a carpenter's degree either, or a plumber's degree, and I'm not too shabby a carpenter, and I ain't too bad a plumber. Well, I kind of figured it, you know. There's a lot of old-timey guys, you know, been around the block, you know, a few times, and they ain't never been to law school. They ain't never been to college. Well, Henry Ford, you know, he built a pretty good-sized business there. Did you know he only went to the sixth grade? Thomas Edison, you know, he's a pretty smart old guy, and he had 1,200 patents, and he only went to the third grade. And when I saw that, I said to myself, you know, just because you didn't get a college degree doesn't mean you can't think, doesn't mean you can't make a little money, doesn't mean that you can't go into court and win a case. Remember that woman, Madeline Murray O'Hara? Madeline Murray O'Hara. Did you know that she went, I talked to her one time, I was over at Larry Flint's place, and old Madeline happened to be there, and this is quite a few years ago, now she's dead now, but then she was an old lady when I knew her. And she'd argued seven cases to the U.S. Supreme Court pro se. Did you know that? Seven! Won seven out of seven. Not too bad for an old woman in Tennessee. Of course, I never did agree too much with her political and religious philosophy. She's a communist, you know, but you know, it takes all kinds. So next time somebody tells you that what you need, boys and girls, is a good lawyer, tuck it away in your heart. Maybe what you need is somebody with some good common sense. I can't think of anybody with more good common sense than you. Can you? Hey, we're out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll be back with more on the lawyers when we come back tomorrow night. Remember, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.